For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Father, it's a great thing to be in your service together. Lord, we love being together, as is evident by our difficulty finding a seat. Lord, we don't get enough time to hang out with other Christian workers, it feels like. This is a sweet opportunity. Thank you for it. Lord, thank you for the privilege we also have of opening your word and studying it together, reflecting on your truth, being changed by it. God, I just pray that you would really meet us here this morning, continue to meet us. It's been some really great and tasty teaching out of your word already. Just ask God that we can go away changed and that we can impact our world for you. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so, you know, when we got together as elders and started talking about this retreat, we talked about this sense of the imminent return of Christ. And the whole idea of imminence to me is kind of a puzzle. You know, sometimes, especially as a younger Christian, I would read how Paul would say things like, you know, we need to act as if Jesus is going to return any minute. And I thought to myself, but wasn't he wrong? I mean, that was a long time ago. What does that actually mean to us today? What if, as we read the signs of the times, there's still the sense that even though we're closer, there's still some things that need to happen before Jesus returns, based on what he said in Matthew 24. How do we live with a sense of imminence? It's an interesting question. And this last week, as I've been pondering this as I've been preparing my thoughts for today, and last week I had something happen. It was kind of interesting. I was at a meeting, and there was a brother that was starting the meeting, and he said, all right, I want everybody to take a minute, and I want you to imagine that in 5 minutes, you're going to have a face-to-face meeting with Jesus, and you can ask him anything you want, but you can only ask him for two things. What would it be? So I sat there, and I thought about it. And then, as he was starting up to go on to something else, the thought occurred to me, because I came up with my two things. The thought occurred to me is, you know what? I can meet with Jesus anytime I want. I don't need to wait 5 minutes to meet with him, and I can ask him anything I want anytime I want. And if those are the two most important things, I already talked to him once today. I prayed this morning. Did I ask him about those two things? Well, I was batting 50%, honestly. And it occurred to me there's a sense of imminence that his little scenario pushed me into. I'm going to meet Jesus. What would I say to him? Wait a minute, I can talk to Jesus anytime I want, but I don't have that sense that I'm about to do something, so I'm not focused about it. That sense of imminence gives us focus. It causes us to think, this may be the last time I'll talk to this person. This might be the last time that I'll get a chance to teach this meeting. I'm going to give it the best shot I can. I'm going to try to communicate as effectively as I can. I want to make this moment count because Jesus could come back anytime. And when we begin to think about it in those terms, that it's about thinking in the immediate. How do I maximize my life, my resources, the things God's given me, the opportunity for community, for the kingdom? It changes how we think. I found that true for myself, specifically in the area of teaching. I think the longer I taught the word, I started to get into a sense of a rhythm, like, okay, well, we're just going to teach the word again. And one day I woke up and I realized, you know, this is an opportunity to change someone's life every time the word is opened. Am I taking it that seriously? Do I have this sense that this CT, this home church meeting, this cell group, this is an opportunity for every person here to go away changed forever? And do I take it that seriously? The honest answer was no. I'm embarrassed to admit that, but the honest answer to that was no. And as I began to think differently about that, it changed the way I taught. do we live with a sense of imminence, it does make a difference. And that's how. There's a sense of urgency. You know, in a more of a secular sense of that, I've always admired Jim Tressel, because with Jim Tressel, they're always learning something, right? You ever notice that? When they win a game, well, and they interview him afterwards, he's always like, well, we've got lots of things we still need to learn. And then when they lose a game, he's like, we definitely have lots of things we need to learn. And I always waited till I started tracking this, and after a while, I thought, I wonder if he would ever just say, I think we got it down now, right? And so I waited till the end of the season when they won their bowl game, and well, we got to start working really hard so we can get up to speed for next season. There's always this sense of we need to be working on getting better. Focus, intentionality, a sense of immediacy. And I thought to myself, I think he takes football more seriously than I take my Christian life. That's a sense of immediacy. What would our life look like if we approached everything in our life with a sense of immediacy? Jesus could come back tomorrow. How should that change how I spend my day today? And that's the theme that we're pressing for. And of course, for us, we're talking also in the context of the end of time. There's lots of good reasons to think we are coming into the end of time. It's not necessarily tomorrow. But as Dennis laid out on Friday night, there are a lot of things. If you go back 100 years ago and you look at the signs of the time in Scripture, there's hardly any of them that were fulfilled. And most of them, you couldn't even imagine how they would be fulfilled. In the last 100 years, a significant number of them have been fulfilled. And nearly every other one, you could look at it and say, I can see how that could be fulfilled in the next 10 years. That is significant change. It would give us a sense that we are moving in to the end of time. Do we take that seriously? That's that sense of imminence that we're after this morning. Now, in that context, I've been asked to take a look at the whole idea of loving each other out of Romans 13. So let's turn there. Starting in verse 8, Paul says this. He says, let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For he who loves his fellow man has fulfilled the law. And here he mirrors in thought in this text the same words that Jesus used. Of course, he was asked, what's the most important thing to do, or what's the most important command? And he said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. Love your neighbors yourself. The two great commands he answered. Paul's picking up that same idea when he says, at least on a horizontal level, when we love people, we fulfill the law. It's like How to Follow God for Dummies. Just love people. You got that down, the rest of it will all fall in line. And Paul goes on, the commandments, do not commit adultery, do not murder, do not steal, do not covet, and whatever other command there may be, everything else is summed up in this one rule. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to its neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. And this very clearly pulls up this image or the ideas that Jesus talked about. Because when he brought that up, he was also queried by a teacher of the law, of course. Who's my neighbor? If I'm supposed to love my neighbor, who is that exactly? That's a pretty important question for us legalists who want to figure out who I don't have to love, right? We all have that list. Do I have to love that person? Couldn't I just be a distant friend, right? And so Jesus' response to that is to tell the story or the parable of the Good Samaritan. And the parable of the Good Samaritan is scandalous at just a lot of levels. But the most scandalous part of the parable of the Good Samaritan, of course, is it was the Samaritan who wasn't a follower of Yahweh necessarily. You know, the Samaritans were the people that were left behind after the Assyrians took all the Israelites out and intermarried with the Assyrian people the Assyrians brought in. They were theologically impure. They weren't down with the right way to follow God according to the Jewish mind. These were not the right guys to follow when it came to spiritual things. And yet it was those guys, It was that guy that got involved. It was the religious leader, the religious teacher. It was the followers of God that walked right on by the guy in need. And it was the guy that has no sense of spiritual anything that got involved. And Jesus said, that's the guy right there. You should do like he does. Get involved in loving people. This was a scandalous thing. And Paul is referring back to this idea. Getting involved in loving people. He goes on, he says, and do this understanding the present time. Here's the sense of imminence. The hour has come for you to wake up from your slumber, because our salvation is nearer now than when we first believed. The night is nearly over and the day is almost here. And here he uses this term, the day, and it really can go two different ways. And I think he intends both. The first is this idea in a society that didn't have alarm clocks, you got up when the sun came up. So when the night is almost over and the first light of dawn came, only the lazy people stayed in bed. Everybody else says, get up. It's time to do something. Especially because it gets hot around noon and you don't want to be working in the afternoon. So you get out of bed at the first light of dawn. And he's saying exactly that. It's time to wake up from your slumber. The first light of day is just about ready to be here. We need to be on it. And of course, the other thing that he's referring to and alluding to is the day here is the day of the return of Christ. The day is almost here. So let us put aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. A phrase I don't like how this is interpreted, so I want to talk about that just briefly. This particular word, hoplon, an instrument designed to make ready for military engagement, or a weapon. And the reason I don't like the translation is when we think about wake up and put on your armor, we think, oh, that means somebody's going to attack me and I need to defend myself. That's what armor's for, right? That's how I think of armor. But that's not exactly what he's saying. He's saying get up and get your gun. We're going to do some battle. It's time to do some battle because the light's coming. The day is almost here. Let's get on it. Let's get our armor. Let's get our weapons. Let's do some war. And I think that it's that more powerful sense of aggressive activity that he's calling us to in light of the sense of urgency. Let us behave decently as in the daytime. Decently, I wince at that translation. There's a sense of appropriately. Decently kind of feels like you should have the right tie that goes with your shoes or something, right? You shouldn't talk a certain way. We need to be decent. And that's not really the sense of what he's saying here. What he's saying is we need to act consistent with the moment that we're in. We need to be appropriate to the time. And it's daytime. Not in orgies and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and debauchery, not in dissensions and jealousy. That's nighttime activities. That's what the world does in the darkness. The light is coming. We need to align our lives with that. We need to get our weapons together. Instead, we're to clothe ourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ. And do not think about how to gratify the desires of the sinful nature. So there's this contrast. And I think here, this clothing ourselves with Jesus reminds me of us being baptized into the resurrection of Jesus referred to in Romans 6, a couple chapters earlier. This sense that we are to live out the life of Christ flowing through us, reaching lost people with his love. And that's how I would summarize this whole section in Romans 13. He's saying we need to wake up, the time is urgent, and we need to love people in the name of Christ in a very proactive, aggressive way. It is the love of Jesus Christ that penetrates the darkness. That's what we need to be about. So living like the day of the Lord is imminent will give us a sense of urgency, or maybe I should say should give us a sense of urgency to love other people. That's his point. I find it a little bit ironic in some senses, because while that's true, this is also true. Dennis read this last night, Matthew 24. It says, then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. And at that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached to the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So right before the end, there's going to be this great falling away. And who's his audience here? These are his followers he's talking to. He's saying that people like you and I and others in our American Christian community and global Christian community, when it comes down to the end, while Paul in Romans is saying it's time to boot up and love people as aggressively as possible, he's saying here that most people won't. There's a good chance the suggestion here is most followers of Jesus will go the opposite direction. They will stop loving people. They will fade away. They will even go so far as hating each other, betraying each other, turning away from the faith. The opposite of what you would expect, given what Paul's saying. There is a danger that we could be in that list. The person that's most at risk to be on that list is the person that thinks that couldn't happen to them. So how do we stay off that list? That's a really important question. Before we go there, I want to talk real quick about this. The reality is, just like many other signs of the time, the sense that the love of people is growing cold, I think, is growing. Here's a couple trends I just want to note about American culture first. I could just throw a lot of stats up here about family commitments. We all know that divorce, 50%, has been for a long time. The American family is on the ropes, it feels. Here's an interesting tidbit, though. This is the percent of the population that's actually getting married. And notice from 2000 to 2009, it goes from 8.2 per thousand to 6.8 per thousand. We're even giving up on the idea of being committed to each other. So even though the divorce rate's bad, it's even worse when you think about the fact that, in addition to that, there's all these so-called families, because we tend to still call them that, where people aren't even willing to make a commitment. How about this? This is fascinating to me, because how we treat the weak in a culture says a lot about that culture's values. Abuse and neglect are growing in our culture. Here's a staggering number. The number of child deaths per day due to child abuse and neglect from 95 to 2007. It's climbing fairly aggressively. Overall, child abuse reporting rates have risen by an average of 4% each year between 2000 and 2005. 4% a year it's going up. The total number of reports of child abuse has increased nationwide by 49% since 1986. How do we take care of our kids is a really good indicator of how much we really care about other people. If you can't even love your own kids so much that you'll abuse your kid, the likelihood that you have a love for anybody else is pretty thin. I didn't even know there was such a thing as elder abuse as a category. There's actually a national center on elder abuse because it's a skyrocketing problem. 2 out of every 3 elder abuse victims are women, and more than 2 in 5 victims were age 80 or older. Who abuses an 80-year-old? Apparently, a significant number of people. And what's even worse, slightly more than half the alleged perpetrators were female. Most alleged perpetrators were adult children or other family members. The people abusing are older people as their own family. What does that tell you about our culture? self-focus and selfishness. This was an interesting study that was done by Barna. And in some ways, it's kind of lighthearted and lame, and in other ways, I think it's insightful, which is why I used it. This is what kind of New Year's resolutions we make as a culture. Americans, not surprisingly, focus on self-oriented changes. Among those planning to make New Year's resolutions in 2011, this was a recent study, the top pledges relate to weight, diet, health, money, debt, finances, personal improvement, addiction, job and career, spiritual, church-related are kind of scraping along at the bottom, and education. While people concentrate on themselves when making priorities for New Year's Eve, it is telling, this is his editorial comment, it is telling that so few Americans say they want to improve relationships with others. There were virtually no mentions of volunteering or serving anybody, only a handful of comments about their marriage or parenting, almost no responses focusing on being a better friend, and only a small fraction of people mentioned improving their connection with God. If loving others and loving God are kind of indicators of how we're following God, this is an indication of what our priorities are. I want to look good, I want to be rich, and I want good times for me and my family. What I don't want to do is invest in other people, deepen my walk with God, sacrifice. And I don't have any stats just because I felt like it was so self-evident, and it's been brought up already by a couple of other folks, the amount of electronic gadgets and the connecting that we do electronically that's substituting for substance and relationships in our lives. This just goes right at the heart of whether we know how to love people. We're not even authentically engaged with people. You can't love someone you don't even know. Here's something, though, that also I want us to think about. Our culture is becoming globalized. Dennis made the comment, and I agree with him, this is the reversal of Babel. It's also really intriguing to me for this reason. How does God deal with debauched cultures? This global monoculture, by the way, this is a brand new topic in anthropology. Global monoculture or globalized culture, you can Google those and you'll find that it's a brand new idea, but there's already battle lines being drawn. Some people trying to preserve the cultures of the subgroups and other people thinking it's a really great thing. Matter of fact, here's a quote from a guy that does think it's a great thing. He says, the homogenizing influence of globalization that are most often condemned by the new nationalists and by cultural romanticists are actually positive. Globalization promotes integration, the removal not only of cultural barriers, but of many of the negative dimensions of culture. Gee, I wonder if following God will become one of those someday. Globalization is a vital step towards both a more stable world and better lives for the people in it. So there's a significant number of people that are openly embracing this. Here's a thought that I have. This is just my speculation, but it ties this to the end times. What happens when a culture gets debauched? Well, it happened before the flood, right? God destroyed the whole world except for one family. It happened in Sodom and Gomorrah. God wiped out the whole town except for Lot and his two daughters. But since Babel, God has actually been working a different plan for most of the time. He uses one culture to conquer another culture and kind of wipe it out, start over, right? That's why he had the Israelites wipe out the Canaanites. He says in Genesis that he'll draw them back 400 years later when the sin of the Amorites is complete. We see how he uses Babylon to discipline Israel. And you read the prophets, you read in Isaiah how he used Assyria to discipline Moab and Ammon and even Paul, when his speech in Athens in Acts 17, talks about how God sets the times, the geographical boundaries and the times of, meaning the history of and the length of countries and political realms. There's this sense that God says, okay, enough's enough, and I'm gonna start over. I'm going to bring another culture in to conquer you, to reset the clock on the decline of your moral values as a culture. What happens when there's only one culture again? And that's what happened with Babel, is they got back to the way they were before the flood. So God confused their languages so they couldn't have a monoculture, and that gives him the ability to discipline certain cultures out of existence. What happens when we have a monolithic, debauched culture around the globe? Well, I don't have an exact answer for that, but it kind of sounds like the end of time again to me. Here's the really disturbing fact. Most polls on Christian behavior suggest we're not that different from this growing loss of love in American culture that we're exporting globally, that a lot of the behaviors of American Christians are not that different from the rest of the culture. So when Jesus talks in Matthew 24 about the love of people growing cold, there's good reason to be concerned. So I want to take just a few minutes to talk about what causes our love to grow cold, because I think that's really what I want to navigate towards. How can we make sure we don't fall into this significantly dangerous hole? Here's the first one. A lot of talk about war. But you know, there's a lot of Christians who don't think they're at war. They certainly don't live like they're at war. If we're not at war, we're not really ever going to get hot for God. We're not going to be passionately out loving lost people in the name of God. Well, that's a significant problem. Notice in 1 John, it says, "Do not love the world or anything in the world, for if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." How can you love people when you don't have the love of God in you? And he's saying that the love of the world will push the love of God out of your soul. You've got nothing to give if you love the world. People who aren't at war with the world system are going to be incapable of effectively loving people snared by the world system. Where are you at with that? Do you think and live like you're at war? Do you view the world system as an enemy? I think a lot of us live like it's kind of bad, but it's kind of fun too. And it's bad if you get too much of it, but did I mention it was fun too? I have a different lens on life because of the work I do, being mostly urban for the last decade or so of my life. When you work in an urban culture, the cycle of the enticement of sin to the despair and destruction that sin causes is a little quicker and a little more evident than when you live in some other culture groups. You see people at age 20 who've done it all, had it all, who have a criminal record, who dropped out of school, who have drug habits and three babies' mamas and no job and no... and it was fun. It was a great ride for about 2 years. And now they look at their life and it's destroyed. And it's really easy in that context to look at the world system and realize this is horrible and we don't want to have anything to do with it. To really genuinely hate the world system and feel a sense of embattlement with it is a whole lot easier when you see the destruction so vividly right in front of you. Sometimes I think in less evident ways, American culture is such that we, even as Christians, can think, well, the guy's a pretty good guy. Ever hear people talk about, well, he's a good guy. Good guy means that he kind of pays his taxes, didn't go to jail that we know of, is pleasant to me when I meet him. But when he's 60, looks back over his life, and his life is just as trashed as the young man I'm talking about from the hood. It all looked good most of the way. It's a little more deceptive. Are you at war with that? Do you realize it's just as destructive? And are you at war with it? Here's one. Reasons that our love could grow cold. We're not that good at loving other people, so we just let other people do that, right? Everybody's got a gift in the body. I'm not gifted at loving people. And I got to tell you, there's probably few people in this room that are less gifted at loving people than me. You know, I always used to think that loving people is kind of an emotional thing, and I have one emotion, and I use it up usually on anger, so I don't have any left over. I had to work really hard at getting out of remedial loving people. But you know what? We don't get a pass on this. This is not like for some of us and not the others. This is for all of us. If you struggle at loving people, well, welcome to the human race. Right? This is hard. But we can't just duck out and say that's for other people. Well, here's one. I've fallen into this too. Because I struggled with the one, this was real easy for me. I wasn't even trying to love people. I was just doing ministry, right? Again, this might not resonate with any of you, but it might with some of you. Where it never occurred to me that ministry was a subset or under the umbrella of actually loving people. I thought, well, loving people, that's a good thing. In ministry, that's what I'm doing over here. So when I get done doing that, maybe I might work on the other thing. It took a while before it got through my thick skull that ministry being done outside the context of actually loving someone isn't really godly ministry. Here's one. We have identity issues mingled with ministry expectations. When we do that, we start saying to ourselves, for me to do ministry, I got to have so much fruitfulness in certain amount of times, because after all, I want people to really see, and I need for myself to see that I'm being successful here. And that success mindset causes me to avoid actually loving a certain selection of people that look a little too hard to deliver to the level I need to get them to in the time that I need to get them there in order for me to feel like I'm a success. So I'll just avoid those people. What happens if everybody does that? Who gets the ministry to people that are hard to love and hard to reach? Yeah, that can cause our love to grow cold as a body. Here's another big one, and this one hits all of us. Loving people hurts in a fallen world. Dennis did a paper on this theme a couple years back. I think it's something we have to keep revisiting, especially the closer we get to the end, the more our culture loses the capacity to love people, the more damaged people get, the more we're going to be in a ride of getting involved with people who will hurt us as we try to serve them and love them and minister to them. Sometimes the people you love make destructive choices in spite of your best effort to encourage otherwise. If you're doing ministry with them and not loving them, that doesn't bother you. If you're loving them, when you see someone that you love passionately making a super destructive choice in spite of all efforts you've made to encourage them, that hurts. And even a guy like me who struggles with having a second emotion going on, get that. That hurts. You plead with the Lord. Lord, help them not be so foolish. You struggle because you can't decide for them. Sometimes the people you love don't love you back. Or worse yet, will use you. Will use the fact that you're loving them and manipulate you to accomplish what they want. You may not see that coming until it's too late. And then you feel used and thrown away. That hurts. Sometimes the people you love and serve reject and criticize you for the effort. Ever had that happen? That really ticks me off. That's my first response, that I get angry. But what's underneath that anger is I'm deeply hurt. This person that I prayed over, gave time and effort to, resources to, walked beside, in my soul, cried when they cried, rejoiced when they rejoiced, only to have them turn around and talk smack about me behind my back. Or worse yet, right to my face. That hurts. Here's one. Did you know that Satan doesn't play fair? You know, we all know that, but somehow you kind of think, just like a basketball game, well, I know they're the opponent, but they still got to play by the rules, and that somehow Satan should have to as well, right? Maybe you never thought that through, but I think for me it's been easy to just assume that there's just certain things he shouldn't be allowed to do. Wrong. He's a liar, John 8. He comes to steal, destroy, and kill, John 10. He will say or do anything to anyone to hurt you, to hurt them, to wipe out your ministry, to crush and destroy the people you love, be they in your ministry, be they in your home church, be it your disciple, be it in your family, be it your spouse. It doesn't matter. He will do anything to hurt you. Well, I wonder what that's going to be like when the restraining influence is fully lifted. Think it's going to get better? No, it's going to get worse. And in the context of that, it's easy to feel beaten down and quietly, without announcing it, pull back and stop loving people. Stop risking getting hurt. That's easy to do. That's easy to do without even realizing you're doing it. Here's another one. Loving people has become theologically confusing. This really irritates me, so I'm going to try to not spend too much time on it. Ruth will get mad at me for taking all of her time. I think Satan has a strategy in American culture. He has split loving other people into two categories, and he pits them against each other, causing both to lose significant power. And we have bought it hook, line, and sinker. One option is that if you really love people, you express it in deeds without truth. That's called being concerned about social justice and engaged in serving the poor, social ministry. That was popular, then it waned a little bit, now it's becoming popular again with certain segments of the church. The other one is that love is when we tell truth to people. And you don't want to get too involved in serving their needs because, you know, you might get soft and go liberal and stuff. Right? And Satan has stereotyped groups into one or the other camp with nobody really being allowed to embrace both, and these stereotypes just get overlaid. I think of Dwight L. Moody's quote on the one side. He says, don't polish the brass on the sinking ship, right? You ever heard that quote? And as a strong spokesman of the evangelical church, dispensational church, that belief was just put on top of all dispensationalists and evangelicals. We don't get involved in caring for the social needs of people. Our theology doesn't say that. Our Bibles don't say that. Imagine the marketing campaign if Miller Lite came out with commercials that said, it's all about taste and I don't want any of that less filling stuff. And if it tastes good and I get fat on it, that's okay. But if you give me a beer that tastes good and it's less filling, I don't want it. And a follow-up commercial that says, oh, it's all about keeping slim, and so you want a beer that's less filling. And if it tastes great, you wouldn't want that. That would be really dumb marketing, right? Wouldn't you want both? I mean, that's the point of their commercials. It's the same with this. Why is it that we've pitted these two against each other? I believe Satan has done that, and the church has bought this hook, line, and sinker. The maximum kingdom growth happens when both are operating together, when we get involved in the needs that people have, and when we bring the message of God's truth, and when we bring both of those, whenever the opportunity presents itself, that's appropriate to bring it. And that's who we are. That's the way we think. Why have we become bifurcated in our mentality as American Christians? A great example of this is the Bhutanese ministry that got launched here. How did that start? Someone called up looking for blankets, is my recollection on that, and Danny Walker took the call. And he didn't package up some four spiritual laws in Bhutanese language to take with him. He just took some blankets. And he got involved, and what do you know? That opened doors to share the gospel. Jim Leffel, when we were talking about this, talked about one of their contacts. He and some of the folks in his sphere are heavily invested in Haiti. And they saw, as he's talked to some of the people down there, they talk about American Christians who come down and they fall into one of two camps. One camp comes down and serves all the social needs in Haiti, but doesn't really do much ministry from the perspective of the word. They don't teach the word much. They don't evangelize much. They just serve and give food, clothing, and all that kind of stuff. And he said, basically, they've been doing that for years and years and years, and it makes no difference. If anything, it's created a dependent culture. And by contrast, there's the evangelists that come down and run tent meetings and then pack up, and they lead, you know, a bunch of people to Christ, and then they leave, and there's no relevance of how that now plays out in the rest of my life. Neither one really works. He said, it's the people who come down who do both that make a difference down here. This is how God designed it. Why have we become pitted against each other? Because Satan has done this, and we've fallen for it. And the effect is the love of the church has grown cold. Lastly, it's probably not the last one, it's the last one I've got. What causes our love to grow cold? We try to do it in our own strength, with our own wisdom, under our own capacity. And I'm not going to go into depth on that because Gary's going to be talking about some of that. How do we gain strength and wisdom and capacity to love other people? He's going to get into that some tonight. All right, so to try to wrap this up then, why should we love other people? There's really two thoughts I had on that. One is to be found faithful. And I put a question mark because I'm not sure that's a good one. But that's the one that a lot of people would come to. Why would we love people? Because we're supposed to. It's kind of obedient. We want to be faithful with what we've been given. I think it's very easy to fall into legalism. We're loving people out of obedience isn't probably the best motive. Here's a much superior motive. Because Christ is imminent. And Jesus is who we're becoming like him as sons and daughters. We're being conformed into the image of his son. So why wouldn't we want to act like he would while we have a chance? Do you want to be like Jesus? I do. He loved people. That's the rubric under which he came to this earth, to love the world. Again, I've spent a lot of my Christian life having really screwed up ideas. And one screwed up idea I had for a long time as a Christian was that, you know, serving people and loving people and stuff was really hard. And I couldn't wait for Jesus to come back so I didn't have to do that anymore. It was both an exciting and a sad day when it occurred to me that, no, I was actually going to become like him. So that would be the way I would want to live for the rest of eternity. If you've ever fallen into that line of thinking, then you love people because you have to, or you feel like you're obligated to, or you're trying to be a good, obedient son. And I would suggest to you, this is the reason we do this, to become like Jesus. So, my final parting thought, how will we be defined? Will we be defined as an ever more lethargic, intimidated group of people in the face of an increasingly dark world? It's going to get harder. It is getting harder. Is this who we be? If so, I quit. I'm out of here. And I hope you are too. We can't let this happen. And we are moving into an age when doing ministry and loving people is getting harder. This is not an option for us. I love the fact that I can say that knowing that this group of people shares that passion. We don't want to be this. Instead, we need to do this, putting on the weapons of light and breaking down the gates of the city of hell with the love of God. You know, when Jesus talked to Peter, he said, on this rock I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against the church. The gates of hell are a defensive mechanism. They have the city wall and the gates, and they lock the gates and they keep the enemy out. We are the people with the power of God and the love of God who can storm the city of hell, break down the gates of hell, and rescue the people who are in hell or on their way to hell with the love of God. We have the power to do that because we have the power of Christ in us. This is the kind of mentality we have to have. If we do have anything less, we will never succeed at loving lost people in an increasingly dark world.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.